All right, well, welcome to spring. I mean, we always knew we were going to do a spring show, but what does that mean, really? I mean, the official astronomical start of spring was March 20th, but if you live in New Orleans, where I was last week for my beautiful friends Mike and Kathy's wedding, love you guys, spring was like a month ago. And if you're listening in Minnesota, spring might not be for another month or two. So maybe we thought a spring show should really be about rebirth, about seeing the sun and lightening up and growing. And that brought us to seeds. Dan Barber is a chef. One of his restaurants, Blue Hill at Stone Barns, was ranked the 11th best restaurant in the world. But right now, he's focused not on growing his restaurants, but growing new seeds. He's the co-founder of a new company called Row 7 that's all about breeding varieties of fruits and vegetables that we've never tasted before. Now, seed companies are not new. And if you're a gardener, you know, you're probably shredding all the seed catalogs you get every year for mulch. But what is new is that this is a seed company that brings in chefs to help direct breeders on what flavors to breed for in their vegetables. And the breeders know what will make these seeds viable on a large scale. This can actually change how we all eat. So hey, Chef, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, we talk a lot about knowing where your food comes from, right? And I think, you know, I actually credit you for a lot of that, the way we think about that as a chef, because you're a chef who has famously a restaurant on a farm, and you will bring products from that field directly to the table. You'll bring the dirt from the farm to the table, and you really help us reinforce this idea of where our food comes from. But I think for most of us, what that means is, oh, who's your farmer? Who's the person growing that food? And a lot of us, absolutely me included, don't take that one step further back into, well, where do the seeds that those farmers grow come from?
Right.
So who are the seed breeders? Like, where do they work? Who are these people? Where do they work?
Yeah. Well, this is a late inning revelation for me too. I wasn't asking those questions until one night about 9 years ago. A group of breeders from Cornell University came for dinner, and one of them at the table, I found him to be engaging and articulate, but he asked questions like he was thinking like a chef creating a recipe or something. So I was like, I want to talk more. This guy's name was Michael Mazurek, and he came in the kitchen at the end of the meal, and there was a, you know, we got into a discussion, just like sort of banter. It was late at night, and there was a cook who was prepping a butternut squash in front of us for the next day. And Michael is a squash breeder. So I said, you know, if you're such a great squash breeder, why don't you figure out how to make a butternut squash taste good? You know, instead of like chefs doing these heroics of like roasting and caramelizing and adding, you know, maple syrup and gastriques and stuff. It's like, just create the thing and make it great. And what he said to me, you know, was probably what changed my appreciation for the work that breeders do, and also got me thinking about how to engage them more. He said, you know, in all my years of breeding, no one has ever asked me to select for flavor. Hmm. And I just thought that was nuts. Like, who is he talking to? And of course, in the years that followed, I learned exactly who these breeders are talking to, which is the large industrial food chain. Which for the most part dictates how our seeds are selected and how they're going to be grown. You know, we think of the farming system as the template, but really it's the seed that's a template. It's the blueprint. Mm. And these breeders are creating the architecture for how we eat in the future. And these breeders are not talking to chefs like me or concerned, informed eaters like you. Even though we do represent a growing dynamic cohort of well-educated and demanding. Yeah, these are people who are demanding like flavor in their food, mm-hmm. and want to know more about it. So we need to engage breeders was the end result of that conversation, because we need a seat at the table, and we don't have a seat at the table. Walmart has a seat at the table.
Right.
We don't have a seat at the table. So
right, and industrial producers, like, to your point, they need things bred for shelf life. They need things bred for storability. They need things bred for a certain size so you can transport a certain way.
Yield's a big one.
Yeah.
You know, yields. These are all determining factors. And what you just listed, those are the top Those are the top three. By definition, if you're selecting for those three things, you're selecting against flavor and nutrition, as it turns out. Flavor and nutrition, one of the great moments for me along the continuum of learning about this is the correspondence between flavor and nutrition. Like nutrient density and flavor are the same thing. Like flavonoids are flavor. And so you literally cannot have a jaw-droppingly delicious carrot without a nutrient-dense carrot.
They're
the same thing.
So you're starting this company to, as you put it, get chefs at the table with these breeders and help them think about the possibilities of flavor. But like, what does that mean? Like, you're not saying, could you grow me a watermelon that tastes like grape bubblegum?
That's not the point of the company, but if that is the North Star of a chef, I don't know. I mean, I guess my point is I don't want to shut out possibilities. The suite of possibilities is sort of endless, as breeders have taught me. It's like you need to ask, and they never get asked. What they get asked for are the three things we just talked about before, the shelf life, the uniformity, the yield. And so, the food culture, as it were, is demanding uniformity. It's also demanding a seed that will grow similarly here in the Hudson Valley as it will in Southern California, as it will in Texas, as it will in Mexico, as it will in Canada, as it will in China, because that's how seeds are developed these days. Is that it's a one-size-fits-all approach. So what if we both, A, put flavor and nutrition at the top of the list of priorities, and also recognize that they're vastly different ecologies and geographies and cultural entanglements and histories that we should play into this breeding selection. And then all of a sudden, you start to see a very differentiated possibilities for the same seed as well as different seeds. And that's what's beautiful about seeds throughout history, is that they evolve through this beautiful correspondence between the ecological realities of where they were grown and the cultural realities, and they kind of evolved out of each other. And to that's what's so beautiful about chefs, it seems to me, and the way the food culture is headed, which is, to advertise a sense of place and to tether it to history and to acknowledge some of the environmental conditions and to riff on that. And that's where great food is headed. Yeah. To have a company that's responsive to that, I think it's both a good deal for eaters and also a good ecological deal, because it means you're growing seeds that are appropriate for place.
That's super interesting. So let's talk about these seeds. You have seven different seeds growing, obviously seven different plants. I was reading their descriptions and they sound
delicious.
Delicious, but in some ways like fantastic. In some ways I can't even imagine them. Like, you have a cucumber with fragrance that fills the room. A cucumber is like the most generic, dumb vegetable. It's like you have your dumb salad, your dumb cucumber.
Yeah, right. And that's what we use in our restaurants, unfortunately, because we're sort of forced into that. But, I did a very deep, delicious dive into the history of cucumbers. And what I learned is that cucumbers, first of all, do you know cucumber is poisonous? Like, the original cucumber is poisonous. So what we are eating... What we are eating is it's a weird genetic thing that happened to the cucumber, and all of a sudden there was a cucumber that arrived in the world that did not kill you when you ate it. There's some stories about what was the original, who ate that first cucumber, and it's animals, and people recognize that they were eating something that didn't kill them. Right. And from there, breeding of cucumber happened. And essentially, when you ate it, it was so bitter that it was unpalatable. What happened through the thousands of years of breeding is it became more and more sweet because you were selecting for that sweetness. And then the Dutch got it in their hands and went totally to water and sugar and sweetness and really bland, which is what you're describing, which is what we live off today, are Dutch cucumbers that taste like nothing, especially the way they're grown in hothouses. And it's just a blank slate. But the original heirlooms, the older varieties, have quite a bit of bitterness to them. They don't kill you, but they tingle and they have a depth of flavor that's exciting. And so all chefs are after that exciting flavor. We actually don't look for that kind of sweetness. We're looking for the depth of flavor, and that's right. What you get in these old varieties. So we took an old heirloom and mixed it with some of the modern varieties. And it turns out, the fascinating thing for me of all of this was that there, within that genetic traits that give you that bitterness. So again, it's a very complex cucumber. It's not what you're used to for a cucumber, mm-hmm. but it's really strikingly delicious and memorable. It also happens to have a kind of disease resistance in the field that most cucumbers don't have, especially this thing called powdery mildew, which is a terrible fungus for organic cucumber growers. So just actually by luck, more than a conscious plan, we were after the flavor, but it turns out that it's a very strong plant, and to grow it organically with these genetics is actually much easier. So the yield is good, the disease resistance is good, and the flavor and nutrition are off the charts. And that's that encapsulates what we're trying to do with the company.
So I want to talk about another one of your seeds. Actually, I could sit here and talk about all of them. You know, there are squashes that turn color when they're ripe, so you know when to pick them. Like, that's amazing. But I want to talk to you specifically about the habanada pepper. So this is...
Can I just interrupt you? I just want to underscore what you just said.
Yes.
This, a squash that you pick when it's ripe. I mean, to stop on that one, we have a squash industry that picks 99.9% of its squash when it's unripe. And that's the problem with the adding the sugar and the maple syrup and caramelizing, because the squash is not ripe. And that, you know, it's like we just don't demand ripe squash.
We don't even think of ripeness of squash.
So the breeder said, I'm going to put a ripeness indicator. So it's going to be green, which indicates very quickly that it's not ripe. What squash now that's grown is, it looks fully ripe, but inside it's completely green. And what he's reversed it and said, I'm going to select for the gene that makes you know when it's ripe. And therefore, it's like a vine-ripened tomato. You cannot pick it off the vine until it's ripe. And that assures a kind of flavor, complexity, and deliciousness and sweetness that one can only dream of. It's just that little trick.
Yeah.
But again, he turned to me and said, nobody's asked me to do that because the industry wants to pick it green.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to change the squash culture, but sorry, yeah. I interrupted you with that.
it's like a turkey timer, like, bing, it's done.
Kind
pick
of.
Me.
It assures a kind of flavor that you wouldn't get, yeah.
So let's talk about the habanada, the habanada pepper,
yeah.
which is an habanero mutation.
Well, it's selected. So this is the same breeder, Michael Mazurk, the guy came into my kitchen who's from Cornell, brilliant breeder, and he loves peppers, but he can't stand heat.
Okay.
And so that's where it started. And the habanero for him is the most delicious, exquisite pepper in the world. But the breeding has gone towards the heat because Americans want heat, hot, blasting, overwhelming heat.
Right.
And he's like, you are dissing what habanero really wants to be, which is floral and beautiful and lovely and sweet. And so he selected against the heat and created this, after 7 years, a pepper that he called habanada. So it is completely absent of heat.
Oh, wow. But it has those incredibly, like, heady,
floral. Yeah, yeah. It tastes like fruit. A melon. I mean, it's incredible. And it just gets you to think about a pepper in a whole new way.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you're thinking, heat, this is going to blow my mouth apart.
Yeah.
And also gets you to think about, well, why did peppers, what was it? Chickens... And fowl, they ate this hot stuff, but they didn't taste heat. And that's how peppers spread, is through fowl. They would eat, they didn't get affected by the heat, and then they'd poop out the seed in some other place. And that's how peppers spread throughout the world.
Make it fly, right?
Right. So it's almost like then all of a sudden, every time I eat it, I'm thinking of, like, you know, you have this power over the habanero that you never thought you could have. I think it's really stunning. So that's one of the seeds in the catalog.
That's amazing. So I want to talk about this word heirloom that you bring up.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of us, when we think of, like heirloom seeds, heirloom tomatoes, obviously, like that's almost become like a meaningless marketing term.
Yeah,
but the idea of older seeds, the difference between what you're doing now and just getting older seeds is that those older seeds will have things like, they will produce fruit that may be delicious, but may have low yield, and you're crossing them to make them.
Yes, we're taking what we love about them, making them just, appropriate to place. Because remember, heirlooms are coming from somewhere else. You know, you grow an heirloom here in the Hudson Valley. It wasn't bred in the Hudson Valley. It was bred in France or Italy or China or India, whatever the vegetable is. So just by first stroke, by putting it in the ground, you're making a compromise. It's a plant that was bred somewhere else. Now, That doesn't mean it's going to fail, and it doesn't mean that it won't be delicious. It just means that it could be so much more delicious and so much more productive if you select it for its particular environment. Yeah. So that's what we're doing.
With the ecosystem.
Yeah, yeah. And make it viable not just for me in my white tablecloth cathedral of a restaurant. Because that's the other problem with this, is that these tastes and these flavors that I am so excited about should not be in the
realm of the $300 tasting menu.
Yeah, why? But this makes we tend to think that it's either that or Monsanto maniacs on the other side. And it's that's crazy. Like, actually, we can democratize this, and we can make this into very affordable, delicious, nutritious food if we ask breeders for it. And right. We have to ask. And we want chefs at the table because they curate the stuff every night, and they should be a part of the conversation. Because the reason I love chefs so much, not just because I wear a white coat myself, but because we are ambassadors of flavor. And by virtue of being ambassadors of flavor, we are ambassadors of nutrition. And one and the same thing, remember that. So that is a key component to this. And if you add in the regionalism, the possibility for expression of place, you get a very dynamic and interesting food culture for the future. But it has to start with seeds.
Right. All right, well, here's to the future, Chef.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Dan Barber is the chef of Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, and his latest venture is the Row 7 Seed Company.